Doug Glanville had a pretty good run in Major League Baseball, 9 seasons from 1996 to 2004, an outfielder with the Chicago Cubs, Philadelphia Phillies, and Texas Rangers. His .324 batting average was 8th in the National League in 1999, but Glanville's greatest talent may be his ability to explain what it's like to be a Major League Baseball player, explaining not just what he did, but what it felt like. That was the subject of his book, The Game From Where I Stand. I'm Jim Meadows, and today on Focus, we're replaying the interview Doug Glanville did with my colleague Jeff Bossert in 2011 when his book came out. The interview begins after this hour's news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. If you were following the Cubs or the Phillies a decade or so ago, you may remember Doug Glanville. He was with the Chicago Cubs as a rookie in 1996 and again in 2003, when he was part of the team that came ever so close to playing in the World Series. Glanville's best years were with the Philadelphia Phillies, where he batted .324 for 8th best in the National League in 1999. Before he turned pro, Glanville earned an engineering degree from the University of Pennsylvania. Nowadays, he's an analyst on ESPN and writes a column that appears from time to time in the New York Times. This hour on Focus, we'll listen back to Jeff Bossert's interview with Doug Glanville, first broadcast in 2011 when his book, The Game From Where I Stand, came out.
Welcome, Doug Glanville.
Thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm great. I really enjoy having a former Cub on the program.
Absolutely, yes.
Talk about setting out to write this book. You wanted to explore the human side of the game. You devoted a lot of this book about things as simple as how to pack your bags when you leave spring training for the season, being separated from family for several months, the mental grind of the schedule, how you deal with something like being traded. Did it surprise you that this angle really hadn't been taken on before by someone? How did you decide to write this and realize that this was something you could explore?
Well, you know, and part of it was the inspiration from my opportunity to write this column for the New York Times. I was in my last season, which was 2005, I was sitting in my apartment after the New York Yankees released me, and I realized that this is the moment I'm heading home. I knew that I had crossed over and I wasn't probably going to play baseball again. And that column became inspired by those moments and thoughts you have about realizing your career is about to end and you're moving into this new place. And so my column became called was called Heading Home. So when I wrote it, I was so amazed and pleased at just the feedback. And that really what inspired me was how people would take the stories from the column and run with it and kind of say, hey, this is what I went through. And I thought that this was an untapped area because the feedback was so personal, and I wanted to, you know, explore that a little bit. So the book, it kind of germinated from this wonderful collection of comments that people were making from my column, and most of what they were honing in on was this human element that, you know, players don't really talk about this. I don't really hear this. And so that uniqueness was definitely an inspiration.
Talk about baseball's role in your upbringing in Teaneck, New Jersey. I think you followed the Phillies as a kid. How much did you play baseball growing up?
Well, it was my big brother. It was a big part of how I got into baseball. But I grew up in a town, Teaneck, New Jersey, right outside of New York. And its claim to fame was how aggressive it was in the 50s to really voluntarily integrate its school system. And it became part of the culture growing up there that there was diplomacy, there was sort of interaction across historically divisive lines. I thought that became part of what the children growing up and that the town sort of embraced over time. And so I came along. My mom was a teacher in the school system. My father was a psychiatrist. And, you know, they were very much on the cutting edge of bridging these differences. And by the time I hit my stride in junior high, high school, I was very familiar with just people of all walks of life. And that really brought into focus some of the things I was very passionate about as a writer, and that is talking about creating understanding. And so in my book, it's sort of that's the idea. Like, here's what players actually go through. And until there's an emotionally honest dialogue about it, we're still going to be feeling alien to each other. And I thought it was important it was important to sort of bring into focus that this is there's a lot more common ground. And so TNEC was, you know, taught me a lot of how to go about things in that way, and you know, very much still hold it close to my heart. I had such a great experience growing up there.
Was your first love baseball, or did you have a passion for other sports?
It was definitely baseball. My brother is seven years older than I am, and he always had me out there, you know, rain, shine, snow. He's like, here's a bat. So he introduced me to a lot of sports, but he had a plan when it came to baseball. He had I remember a scorebook that he kept, and there's a list of all the stages to become a major league ball player. One was a game I played called Stratomatic Baseball. It was little cards with dice, and you roll for the results. And then there was wiffle ball, stick ball, and all these things. So he had mapped out my career early on, and I loved the game from day one. I loved the thinking, the pace, the sort of anticipation, and you know, it still sticks with me.
Yeah, I don't imagine there's many playing Stratomatic today. The producer for PBS, Dave McMahon, suggested I ask you about Stratomatic and how often you played that. I mean, what was the earliest age you took part in a game of Stratomatic with your brother?
Oh, we're talking 6, 7 years old. I mean, early on, I was playing against these teenage kids, and what it taught me so much about the strategy behind the game, really how much, you know, how do you make a lineup, for example, was always important. And Stratomatic, they rated these players in every possible way, speed, defense, arm strength, that you had to weigh these factors to decide who you were going to put in. And so I was thinking along those lines very early on. I think it gave me the sort of foundation for the tactical side of the game. And but also what was so significant about Stratomatic is you were able to learn players from all different marketplaces. You know, back then, you know, you only saw your local team, really, or maybe the game of the week. But now, you know, everywhere, ESPN, whatever, you could see teams everywhere on any time, on the Internet, wherever. But, you know, then you had to be the local. So to learn about players in other markets was difficult. But Stratomatic had cards for every single player. So I became very knowledgeable across the entire spectrum of the game.
Who did you emulate coming to bat, like, in Little League? Who was your hero, and you know, who did you want to, you know, whose stats did you want to copy when you reached the big leagues?
Well, I was a Phillies fan growing up, so that was a Mike Schmidt, Gary Maddox, Steve Carlton kind of era. You know, so the late 70s, early 80s when the Phillies were, well, they're dominant now, but they were very dominant then too. And oh, those are the teams. So we played a lot of wiffle ball, so we had the plastic helmets, and I'd, you know, try to imitate all these guys. And to this day, I mean, it became part of my major league batting stance. I had little tributes to different players at different moments in the game, so it stayed with me.
How was it that you came to be selected ahead of Manny Ramirez in the 1991 draft? I mean, I guess there's a lot of players that are chosen much later in the draft, and it just depends on how someone develops.
You know, that's a good question. I think in that time frame, it was 1991 when I was drafted. The Cubs were looking for sort of a, you know, speed, defense, you know, a little bit of a mix of everything. So I kind of gave that, even though Manny was, you know, legendary hitter, he wasn't exactly as versatile in the other parts of the game. So they rolled with it, and, you know, he had a pretty good career. I mean, he had some issues, clearly, from the a lot of the things that brought him down ultimately. But it was just one of those years where a lot of those guys did make the big leagues, but all for different reasons.
We got a caller on the line, line 4 in Champaign. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Enjoying the show. Long-time suffering Cubs fan. So some years, like this year, it's a little bit more difficult than others to follow the team. But this might be a little bit off the topic that Doug wants to talk about, but I wonder if he could lend his expertise. I used to love to listen to Ron Santo to the games. And Ron used to always come back and make a point that the game has changed and changed significantly once they started to hand out multi-year contracts. In other words, in Ronnie's day, I think players basically played from year to year to year, and there was always that pressure and that tension for them to perform. Now it seems like the game is a different animal with these multi-year, multi-million dollar contracts. I wonder if Doug could speak to that and what his take on all of that is. And I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thanks.
Well, you know, there's no doubt that the culture changed. I mean, free agency was a huge part of that, as players earned the right to choose their employer, which I think was an important advance, because when Curt Flood took the reserve clause to the Supreme Court, arguing that you're basically almost like a slavery type of effect where you're owning players to perpetuity. They used to have it where you'd get a one-year contract and there was always an option for the team to just renew. So you never really could negotiate with anybody else. So I think free agency opened it up, and I think it was good to see a true market value when teams, players could sort of negotiate and bid with all these different organizations. But the flip side is players lost the continuity, and fans lost the continuity of players being in the same place, being able to say, oh, well, Mike Schmidt is a Philly for the next 12 years kind of thing. But what that did is it shot up the market value, and the stakes became high. Now, today, players try to get what they can now. It's not this, you don't necessarily have the vision for 20 years. You're thinking, all right, I got to get my big contract, and then I'm set for life kind of thing. And so back in the day when there was much more of a one-year where players even worked in the off season in the markets where they played, there was a lot more pressure to perform. And there were times where great players in Yankee history got pay cuts after good years. So, but there's no doubt that the economics sort of changed the importance and how players weighed where they would go and for what price tag. And so there's been good and there's been bad to that.
We're talking with former big league outfielder Doug Glanville. He's the author of the book, The Game From Where I Stand, the Ballplayer's Inside View. Welcome your calls, questions, 800-222-9455 or immediately around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We reflected a bit on the thanks for the caller, by the way, for that question. We talked a bit about the glory of big league life. Can you talk about the grind of a minor league season? In the book, you talked about getting on that bus and trying to seek out, you know, ads to find an apartment to stay in and who you might be able to, you know, share an apartment with, that sort of life where it's the opposite of what you get when you're in the show or the big leagues.
Yeah, that was a shock, to say the least. I mean, you know, here what happens is you get drafted, you're feeling pretty good about yourself, it's an exciting time, and they play the video and you're in your home saying, welcome to the Cubs, welcome to this beautiful organization, here's all the great things. And then you actually go to spring training, and then you find yourself walking four blocks in like 120 degrees with your bags, and, you know, you're sleeping on floors, you're sleeping in the luggage rack on the eight-hour bus ride. So reality meets the dream very quickly. You still love the game, but it's different. And a lot of these guys, it's the first time they're away from home, you know, so it's a huge adjustment just managing finances because you're not making any money in the minor leagues for the most part. And so that was a challenge. But no doubt over time you start to, you know, recognize that it's partly your motivation to get to the next level. You're like, I don't want to be here. I want to move up. And each level they tease you. The cities get a little bigger. The nightlife's a little better. The travel's a little easier. And then the pay is, you know, improved. So all that starts to way into incentivizing these players to sort of keep getting better to get to that next level. And, you know, I think it's a humbling experience, which I think is a good thing in professional athletics these days, because so often guys are, you know, here it is, it's all in people's lap, and I think you have a greater appreciation when you get there as a baseball player because you've, you know, paid your dues, quite frankly. But there's no doubt that those dues are tough, and many players don't make it.
When you got that call for the big leagues, was it kind of surreal, or was it kind of like, all right, I knew this was coming, but let's get this over with, let's get on to the next point in my career?
Well, you know, I think I expected it to come. I mean, I was a first-round draft pick. I knew I had entree to, you know, get a little bit of a easier path in making it, but I knew I had to also produce, and it turned out it probably wasn't as glorious a moment as I thought it would be. My manager in AAA and I, well, first of all, he couldn't stand me, so we did not get along on any level. So when I got called up, he had to call me in the office to tell me about it, and I knew it was coming because they played me in left field, which is a position they didn't play the whole year. So I knew the Cubs were looking for a left fielder and all that. So I got played left field the night before, and then he calls me in the office with two other players. One player was this guy Mike Hubbard, good catcher. And he told him, Mike, you've done a great job. You've earned it. Congratulations. Then he turned to Terry Shumpert and said, Shump, you've already been here before. You know exactly what to do. Good luck. And then he turned to me and he said, if you make the same mistakes you make up there as you did down here, you're going to be right back here. So that was my send-off. And it wasn't exactly a beautiful send-off, but he couldn't take away from what I'd, you know, finally accomplished. And so it was surreal. And what nothing was more surreal than going to get on a plane to Chicago. I ate at this diner around the corner on Clark Street, Salt and Pepper Diner, and then see my name in this lineup. I mean, I almost didn't believe what I was seeing. I saw Ryan Sandberg. I saw Mark Grace. I saw Sammy Sosa, Sean Dunstan, you know, and then all of a sudden this Glanville guy's in there. it just didn't make sense, but it was so exciting. And I mean, I floated on air for a whole year because you're just going to stadiums you watched as a kid. You're playing against people you read about. I mean, it was just a phenomenal experience.
How does it feel? Well, since we're talking about the Cubs, let's talk about the Cubs in that era. I mean, you're part of a team. It was 97, I believe, that started out 0-14. Oof. How do you go about your work and remain professional and leave work at work and be able to go back to your apartment and just relax, thinking I'm still, you know, a pro athlete and living my dream?
It wasn't easy. It wasn't easy. I mean, I think you learn very quickly, especially as a professional ball player, that baseball is a game of tomorrows. You know, you always have another day. The next day, you're going to see this guy again. You're going to play against this pitcher again. You count on that. And it gives you a little bit of sanity within what could really make you pull your hair out with all the ebbs and flows and ups and downs of the game. And I certainly had my moments where you're just like, how am I going to keep doing this? I mean, you're 0 for your last 20, and you're struggling. But, you know, as a team, in 1997, we started off the year 0-14, and we just happened to play against pitchers that were all phenomenal. We played the Braves and the Florida Marlins to start the season, and looking back, they were basically loaded with Cy Young pitchers, and we lost a bunch of 3-2, 4-3 games. Looked up, and we were 0-14, and the team just started to kind of devolve. I mean, we had fights on the plane and fights over seats. I mean, you just start to get frazzled because you're trying to look for a reason. And then we finally got our first win in New York and felt a little bit better, but we never recovered from that. I mean, I think we ended up winning 75 games, which was pretty good, but we never were in the race, and it's pretty frustrating when you're eliminated in April, for sure.
Well, you mentioned the fights and that sort of thing, the pressure of trying to get that first win. Can you talk a bit about relationships with players? This is your family for a big part of the year. And I think maybe to some of us watching ESPN or the Cubs broadcasts or whatever, you sort of just look upon as a sort of a god. I don't know. We don't think about what your players do once the game is over, you get in the clubhouse and having to share all this time together.
No, there's no doubt. I mean, and it's been said that you definitely spend more time with your teammates than you do your own family. I mean, that's the season. And a lot of guys, you know, have kids and they're getting traded in the middle of the night and they pull their kids out of school. And I mean, it's a tumultuous existence. I mean, when I'm analyzing for ESPN, I always look. One of the things I look for is, like, I'm watching a team, say, and then 2 days later I look again and they're in a different city. You know, it's like, and when I go back to look at my own videos of at-bats and things, I notice, like, my change of uniform and the background, because literally every 3 days you're pretty much on a plane going back or from or to something else. So it's frenetic, and that pace gets to wear on you more than really the performing side, because you just have to deal with so many things as the everyday life is still going by, and your family's taking a lot of burden, whether they're, you know, your wife's raising the kids, or whether your father, in my case, was very sick for 3 years of my career and passed away the last game of the season in 2002. And, you know, so I was, you know, taking calls from the ER. I was flying to emergency rooms. And I mean, it was really difficult time, and the game doesn't give you a break. There's always another game coming at you. And as an adult, you start to see that, you know, well, it's not quite a game anymore, because there's things that you're sacrificing that are very difficult to be able to do what you do.
Well, you talked a lot about your father and when he got sick. And one point, he actually, seeing him very briefly, motivated you to go out and play, have some of your best baseball for another year or two.
No, there was no doubt. I mean, I was extremely close to my father. I mean, he was true. It was just like a soulmate type of connection. And he was born in Trinidad and came to this country at 31 years old after being very established as a teacher in Trinidad. And then, you know, got his medical degree and just did phenomenal work. He's just a very Renaissance type man. And and used to talk to him about everything. So when he got sick, it was after my very good year in 99, and I just didn't play well. But just the way he was someone I could just talk to about what I was going through in life. And so his illness just became sort of central to navigating the life in the game. I mean, particularly being open to the press. People, hey, what's wrong with Glanville? And I'm trying to not tell people. And eventually Terry Francona, my manager, told them on my behalf, and it opened up this floodgate of sort of my challenge with the privacy. You know, even though I appreciated that people were concerned, I didn't necessarily want to tell all these people. But, so my dad, he wrote poetry, and he would express all these things that I would refer to when I was going through a lot of different things in my career that was all of a sudden gone. And so, I mean, the writing part, as I segue to that sense, the writing part became my true connection to him. I didn't find anything before writing that made him feel so present, because I tried to, the pendant and the pictures, and I was like, that's not quite doing it. But he really had a voice in writing, and I kind of found my own within trying to express it, express some of the things he taught me and my family. So, but my dad just was a true inspiration, and it was very difficult to perform with his illness central to my life.
How did upbringing, growing up in Teaneck, not just growing up there, but your parents' influence help you prepare for the mentally for this game and the grind of the schedule and all the things you have to deal with?
Well, they were tremendous. I mean, both had a spirit in education. My mom taught for 27 years in the school system in Teaneck, and no doubt that they gave me balance. They really helped me have perspective that there's other things in life, even though this is what I do and I'm playing hard and I'm working hard, but I don't want to put my eggs so much in that one basket to the point where I become so imbalanced that I can't function outside the game. And I really believe that's a huge part of the drug culture in sport or baseball, as a good example, steroids and so on, because part of it is greed, part of it's money, but part of it is also fear and anxiety that you age precipitously quicker than you do in any other field. And so guys are scared to get kicked out of the game. They're scared of the next guy coming up about to take their job, who, by the way, is a young guy that you just got called up from your own organization. So when you're faced with those scenarios, that type of environment, players do feel almost a sense of desperation because they think that this is it and this is all they put everything in that basket. And so when you and then you're in an environment that almost celebrates your lack of diversity, because it's like, well, hey, your back's against the wall. You're going to do everything you can to earn this paycheck that I'm paying you. Versus like, hey, the guy could do something else. And it took a while to prove that the option to do something else doesn't mean you're less committed to the craft. It just means that when the time comes, there's things that you can exercise. And I think that's if you are fortunate to have the opportunity that I had with my parents, who gave me summer programs and schooling and extra work and just support and all those things that not everybody certainly has, then I did feel confident in my ability to be, just have a more holistic look at what I would do in my life. And that gave me the entree to do exactly what I'm doing now, being able to write and still keep baseball close to me, because they just gave me that sort of foundation.
You mentioned steroids and have admitted you probably lost playing time or maybe had the career cut short because you lost out on guys that were probably using.
Well, there's no doubt there's a correlation to the way the game celebrated certain types of players. I mean, the economics say that there's a period where the power guys, the home run hitters, were the ones who get the big payday. And so on one respect, they probably raised the salary bar, which kind of brought everybody up. But on another respect, they also shortened the careers of players that weren't in that ilk. So if you were a non-power hitter, then like myself, I'm a slap-hitting defensive speed guy, I became much more expendable, much quicker, because I was, you could bring me in the ninth inning to play defense. You didn't necessarily need my skills for the first eight innings. And so it did skew the priority. Now, this is probably typical to baseball. Every 5-6 years is a new cycle of emphasis, and maybe it's a pitcher who pitches to contact. Maybe it's a knuckleball or whatever it is. It changes. And I was part of that change directly with the steroid culture that made my position that used to be much more of a defensive specialty position become a offensive power position, and that certainly shortened my opportunity.
Going back briefly to relationships, you were you're married, but it was after your career was over, and it probably the thing made you respect all that much more the guys that were able to keep up families that through their careers.
Well, no doubt. I don't know how they do it. I mean, it's so difficult to imagine just not being around, being sort of all that the onus on your wife or your the mother of your children. Just it's a lot of commitment, and I think to some degree the spouses accept like, okay, this guy's not going to be here, and I think it also makes for a very difficult reintroduction post career because you leave your career and all of a sudden you're like, well, who is this guy? He hasn't been here for 15 years. Now he's like kind of, telling our son what to do. Now he's, and they're probably, these players don't arrive home in one piece. I mean, they're really broken on some level from the fact that you probably didn't end your career the way you wanted to. You pulled a hamstring, your arm fell off, whatever it is. You just did not end it in this ride into the sunset that we think it happens. Most of the time it's not on your own terms. So they're not at home in a peaceful state either. And so you see the divorce rate post-career just off the charts. I mean, that's where people just have the greatest tension. And most don't make it. So it is a very difficult thing to raise a family. So I appreciate it tenfold more now that I'm able to be home a lot and just see what's involved and what it takes. It's a huge, huge commitment. It's wonderful, but it's all-encompassing.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of a previous Focus program. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're listening back to Jeff Bossert's conversation with Doug Glanville, former outfielder for the Chicago Cubs and Philadelphia Phillies. We're going to take a short break. Stay with us. This is Focus on WILL. Welcome back to Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows. We're listening back to a conversation with former Chicago Cubs and Phillies outfielder Doug Glanville. My colleague Jeff Bossert talked with him in 2011 after the release of his book, The Game From Where I Stand, An Inside View of a Ballplayer's Life.
Let's talk a bit about the game itself a little more. You were, starting outfielder with the Cubs, as we mentioned a while ago. How do you go from being this touted draft pick starting lineup to a guy that has to mentor players like Marlon Byrd and recognize that you're going to play defense late in the game or pinch hit?
Well, I'll tell you, you don't know when it's going to happen, but all of a sudden you look up and you are training your replacement, and it's pretty shocking. But, for my path was not like it's pretty typical of what happens to players if you are fortunate enough to play, 9-10 years in the league. And, I became older. I started having injuries, and I was not as productive, and certainly my father's illness definitely took my focus in a different direction that I could not reconcile in a way to be as productive as I was years prior. And so Marlon Byrd was coming up, and even all along I saw him coming, so but I was always open to it because I saw what players did for me coming up the system. Sean Dunston, perfect example, always pulled me aside and say, hey, talk to me about the game, how to get better. This is how you play hard. This is how you handle your business off the field. So baseball is a very mentor-driven game, and they pass the torch down. And I think most players accept that on some level, embrace it on some level. I saw Marlon Byrd, I saw Jimmy Rollins come up, and I gave him, everything I had in my knowledge because I felt if I was a productive player, I could still play somewhere. And that's generally the case. So, which is why I was able to go to Texas and get a starting job, even as Marlon was coming into his own. But it is a fast and very quick cycle. And, 5 years in, all of a sudden you look up and you're on your way out. And that bell curve is shocking because you're so used to being a starter, doing it every day. And now all of a sudden there's a new era being ushered in town and you can't do a whole lot about it.
Well, in 2003, you were traded back to the Cubs, and you were a reserve, but you were on a team that was on its way to the postseason. I suppose there are obvious questions I could ask, and I probably need to about the end of that season. But talk about the ride going to Atlanta and winning that series and playing a role in that team.
Oh, it was phenomenal. I mean, for starters, that was my only playoff appearance, so that was turned out to be such a highlight. The other thing is I was playing for the Phillies for so many years where all we did was chase the Atlanta Braves and never catch them. So it was extremely sweet for me to finally knock these guys off because they wore us out. Chipper Jones, year in, year out, we were second place or lower. But, you know, Dusty Baker, I remember having us in the locker room before that Braves series, and he's like, do not read what I'm saying in the press. I don't mean it. I'm just trying to play coy. I'm just telling them, you know, oh, yeah, the Braves are a great team. We'll never beat these guys. And then now I'm telling you we can blow these guys out of the water. And so, you know, we played well, and we really believed. And the playoffs were extremely exciting. And just to get a little contribution in there in the NLCS was a lot of fun. I mean, just a great moment. And, you know, keep in mind, that's the season after my father had passed away, the last game of the year before, and I had come back from a torn hamstring to get back on the field. So it really kind of brought together a lot of things I was kind of dealing with and overcoming. So it was especially sweet because of those.
Fans that may not remember or are listening, you had the game-winning triple in Game 3 at Florida. It still blows my mind that that's the next-to-last Cub playoff game victory. It's hard to fathom how long ago 2003 was now.
I know it's amazing how I can't believe it. I mean, you saw how difficult it is to actually make the playoffs, let alone do well. I mean, I know we had a disappointing ending to it, but it just to get that far is very, very difficult. I've seen better teams just get knocked out in the first round. I mean, so we had something special. It just fell short for sure.
Well, and talking about the what happened to that team back at Wrigley, the Bartman game, I think you had a really nice perspective on it. A lot of players say, you know, it wasn't his fault. He's a fan. He's reaching for a foul ball like any other fan would. But you even compare it to some comments Tony Muser had made with the staff of the Cubs. You know, it's just a foul ball.
Just a foul ball, you know. And, you know, look, I feel horrible for Steve Bartman. You know, I'd be the first one campaigning to, like, you know, give this poor guy a break. I mean, you know, because I've seen so many angles and footage of him, and he just looks sick to his stomach. And he, you know, any lifetime fan, as many other people around him did, they went for the ball, you know, and in the end, it is a foul ball. It's not like he, you know, the robbed a home run or, you know. I mean, we had an opportunity after that moment, the same opportunity we had before that moment. And you have to tip your caps to the Marlins to do what great teams do, and that is when you get an extra opportunity, you kick the door down. That's the difference between the Yankees and perennial winners and mediocre teams, because every team is stacked with talent. They're first-round draft picks. They're All-American. You could pick the worst team in baseball, Houston Astros or whoever. They're loaded with talent. The difference is experience, production, consistency, resources. And so these teams, you know, like the Yankees, they kick the door down. And because you watch any of the Yankee games or teams that are very dominant, there's always one play that changes things. The game's 3-2. It's 2-1. It's 4-3. But in the seventh inning, they put up four runs. Why did they put up four runs? Because they didn't quite turn that double play, and now all of a sudden they broke it open. So that it's a microscopic difference between these teams, and why I tip the cap to the Marlins is they got the opportunity, and you know Castillo could have just struck out, but he didn't. He battled. He fouled off some more. And then ran hard on a ball, put pressure on our infield, didn't make the play, and then they ran us out of the stadium. So I still think it's much more a credit that you have to give to teams that get opportunities and do something with it.
So you mentioned the hamstring injury. Maybe you could talk about that game, that moment, and how you not only physically rehab from that, but mentally get yourself back into the game.
I mean, I had never had anything like that happen to me. I mean, I was a very healthy player, even with my 170-pound soaking wet frame. But I was able to stay healthy, and it was one of those things, just wear and tear over my career. I was just running a normal ground ball, and my hamstring popped. I learned there's three hamstring muscle groups, that tendons that attach the muscle to the bone, whatever it was. And that was it. And so now I question everything about my future, because speed is my game and my leg is not right. That didn't sound well. But fortunately, I had a doctor that had seen this injury before, which was usually misdiagnosed as like a pull, and got an MRI, which is now you see it as standard. Every time someone pulls a hamstring, they MRI. And that was torn. So I had surgery. And, you know, you can function perfectly fine with two of your three hamstring muscle groups, so it's fine. And I was able to come back. But it's just the rehab, you know, breaking up scar tissue and 6 weeks and just going back to the minor leagues and limping around the field. And it was very difficult to just see the light at the end of the tunnel. But I just kind of kept doing it day to day. And then one day, the irony of this is the best day that I had was the day I took off. I finally went to them and said, I need a day off. This is just, I got to take a day. And they fought me a little bit, and they said, all right, fine. And the next day after that, I improved every single day. And then by, 6 weeks or so, I was able to kind of get back into the flow. But it took another month or so to feel 100% back. I mean, it was very slow. And going into free agency, not the best timing in the world for sure.
A lot of your career was in center field. Did you think an engineering degree would help you? And at what point did academia no longer apply to playing baseball?
I thought it walked hand in hand with my career. I mean, studying for your opponent in any sport, but baseball in particular, is an academic pursuit. I mean, you really have to know your stuff, and you're studying spray charts, and you're studying tendencies and patterns, and you have to be prepared. Otherwise you're going to be out the door. And so getting that edge was important. And so I thought the tactical side of the game, the academic sort of helped. I mean, you can't, you don't want to overthink, and then you really don't actually act. But it was very helpful in terms of the tactical side of the game and just sort of analyzing data. But now it became such a huge part of my transition. That's really where it became more key, just being able to, go out of the game and look into some other opportunities. I think it just helped to have my degree and just had dabbled in other things before to see what was out there.
We've got a caller on the phone, line 4, and Bradley, go ahead.
Hi, Doug. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Hi.
I was curious, during the course of writing your book, did you have much of an opportunity to talk with any of the foreign players, be they from Latin America or from Asia, as to like what additional challenges they face? And I kind of thought of this with the developments of the last few days where Hideki Arabu apparently committed suicide.
I definitely spoke to players that I'd probably say it this way. They were in that position earlier in their career, and over time they were teammates, and then they sort of made the adjustment. But it is extremely difficult, especially, the resources are getting better, but you have players who, from Latin America that are, don't speak any English, and they're 16 and away from home. I mean, it's horrible for them for a while. They go through a lot. I remember players that could only order one food because that's all they knew, and they try to cook in the hotel and then try to just find friends. But as they move up, there was less diversity in that way the higher you went. And because usually there was a lot of Latino players that come in from the Dominican Republic and so on into spring training, and then you look up on the AA team and there's only two players from the same country. So I found it to be really challenging. And so I can't imagine. I played with Chan Ho Park, for example, who was long adjusted by the time I played with him, but he said it was a nightmare for him. But he had like an escort everywhere he went, and he just, didn't have any friends, and he had paparazzi following him because he was such an icon back in his country. So it's a lot of responsibility, and it, makes it a real big challenge for them.
Thanks so much for the call. You were the first African-American Ivy League-educated major league ball player, but apparently you didn't know that right away.
I didn't really know that right away. I didn't know, certainly wasn't really thinking about it. I figured maybe something in, just after Jackie Robinson. I wasn't sure, but it came to light because there was a player with the Padres named Will Venable who went to Princeton who came up, and then they called me and said, hey, I want to do a story on you. Will Venable's up, and another African-American Ivy Leaguer, and then they said he was like the second. I was like, oh, okay, I guess that makes me the first. So I really looked into it a little bit more, and very exciting. I mean, my parents were already thrilled just by having the Ivy League degree and just being able to have so many wonderful opportunities from that. But just to combine it with the passion for baseball just was a beautiful combination that very proud of. And I called Will Venable actually after I wrote an article for the New York Times about it, and he was very gracious and just told him, hey, just you bookend the story. So this is pretty cool.
Can we talk about, you sort of reflected on this, talking about players born overseas, but the image of players, you had devoted a whole lot in, early on about spring training and photo day and the way that players wear their pants. This is a pretty big deal because it is baseball cards or obviously the what way someone will be seen on national TV, especially nowadays with all the broadcasts.
Oh, yeah. You have to take photo day very seriously. You go to spring training, it's like 6 a.m. You rolled out of bed. And now you have to take photos for, like, every media outlet on the planet. So it's like, you know, it takes a while to go through station to station for each photo session. And so when you do take that picture, you're immortalized. It's not going back, so you better be ready. And nothing is more, you know, frightening to see your face on a huge jumbo scoreboard when you, like, have one eye open or you're, you know, still out, your hair is like you just rolled out of bed. So you got to take it seriously. And, you know, we've had days where if guys aren't ready, they get teased to no end from their teammates. So we have to represent well. But if you slip up, no turning back.
You also reflected on some characters of the game in your book. We're talking with Doug Glanville, former big league outfielder. We welcome your calls in the last few minutes of the show, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You talked about, his name escapes me, the former outfielder with the White Sox, Carl Everett, and some of his beliefs, and guys that were dedicated to the game, but interesting personalities.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's definitely. And I called Carl when I wrote this book because I said, Carl, now I'm going to tell some stories about you now. You got to give, let me hear your version, even though I was there. So Carl was very gracious, but he was definitely one of the more notable players I played with. And I mean, he was, you know, just passionate and loud and just like opinionated, but then also played. He was a great teammate. He, you know, loved to help young guys, but he just had that switch that can flip at any time. And so, yeah, there's one day I talk about in the book how he didn't agree with the third base coach's way to signal him if he was on second base on his lead that a guy might be trying to pick him off. So he didn't like the use of words, and he started debating it, and it kind of exploded. And it ended up where he turned a table over on, like, kind of like part of the team, and it took about three or four guys to pin him in a locker to get him to kind of calm down because he was so upset at one of the coaches had said to him in response to him asking all these questions. So it was intense, and Carl was one of those guys that was the exact polar opposite to how I went about stuff, so I learned a lot. But I also realized that, you know, this is a guy that was able to be himself. He's a great player, and I thought back to the sort of how Jackie Robinson had to break in with this sort of silent strength that ate him alive in some ways internally. And then all of a sudden you had Carl Everett, who could sort of be explosive and still have a long career.
Is there anybody out there that fans have the wrong impression of, that maybe there's this wide opinion, this guy's a jerk, but maybe it's just the way that they carry themselves onto the field and they're actually the nicest guy, or maybe you know, vice versa? And I'm not asking you to give us deep details about someone's personality, but some of that may come out wrong out on the field.
No, that's true. I mean, there's guys I watch now as an analyst, like, oh, this body language. I mean, there's players you just look at and you just kind of want to throw up. I mean, Jim Edmonds is like that for me. Like, and you know, I heard he was a fantastic guy. I never got to know him, but it's just sort of body language, you know, and maybe based on nothing. You're just looking. And I'm sure Kenny Lofton was a teammate of mine that, you know, he did all the handshakes and all that. So you can see how an opponent would be, like, annoyed. But on the same team, you know, there's guys like that, like you would have loved to play with Jim Edmonds, clearly. So, you know, it's just a perception thing, and, you know, it's hard to manage. I know Tim Wakefield and I, you know, we got into like a little chat back in Double A, and, you know, and you know, the thing about baseball players, you it's long grudges. You never forget. So you remember it back 15 years later, you're trying to get the guy in the parking lot. I mean, that's how it is. But a good example for Chicago, Sammy Sosa. He's a good example because, I mean, he was a fun teammate. I'll say that. He always came happy. He's always joking. He always kind of kept it light. He played hard. He worked hard. I mean, he had a lot of things that he did just like his own. He was like kind of OCD about how he trained, and sometimes that kind of spilled over into other people's routines. And so he just had rituals. He was like, this, I eat at this time. I eat this. I use this coach only. And so, yeah, that's not very flexible when you have you know, 24 other guys trying to use the same coach or whatever. But, you know, I think he had fun. I mean, that I always appreciated in Sammy. I tell a funny story in the book about how he tried to get me to get him water during a game. And I looked at him like he was out of his mind. So I did eventually get him water, and then he refused to talk to me. But that was until Michael Jordan came to the game and went looking for me because I played against Jordan that one year he played baseball. And Jordan, you know, Sammy saw me and he started like picking me up at my apartment. He's like, "Hey, how you doing, man? I'm gonna take you." It's like, "Oh, now I joined the club." So, Sammy, I got Sammy's confidence when Michael Jordan wanted to call me. So that was pretty fun.
Talk a bit about for a minute about unwritten rules in baseball. I'm thinking about conversations with the first baseman after you get a base hit. Did you have anybody, like an opposing player, where that relationship kind of grew a bit after you? Maybe didn't say anything after those, you know, first three or four seasons you faced each other.
Yeah, well, there's always a variety. Most guys are like, "Hey, how you doing?" Or "You're happy to be there. You just got a hit, of course. You know, you're feeling pretty good." Like Sean Casey was the mayor. He just was very nice. And now, you know, you're working on looking at the pitcher because you might have to steal second, so you can't get too caught up in it. But then there was a guy like JT Snow who didn't speak for, like, as far as I remember, the first, like, 8 years I played against him, and then all of a sudden one day he just sort of started talking. I was like, "Oh, all right," you know. So I used to remember thinking, like, saying hi, and he literally didn't say anything, nothing, didn't answer. And, you know, it's fine. I mean, he's entitled to that. I think some people are annoyed by the fraternization, so but I just sort of gave up on it. And at one point I got over there and he said, "Hey, what's going on?" I was like, "Oh, okay," you know. So you do remember that, but you don't have a lot of time, but it is usually a point where you just sort of say what's up.
How do you you root for any teams now privately? You're analyzing a bunch of them. Do you root for your former clubs, or is it hard to do this because you're following up on what everybody's doing as an ESPN analyst?
You know, it's tricky. I mean, it's more about relationships. It's sort of why I even, you know, the spirit of the book. I really wanted to get into the relationships that drive these athletes and how they, even the one with themselves. And so, from looking at the game now, I kind of see players and owners that I played for or with, and I kind of, you know, Jimmy Rollins, guys like that that I, you know, support because I just remember him as a young kid coming up. I think I appreciate, you know, just various players, just how they go about the game. It's random. I mean, it could be on any team, any league. It's no, you know, it doesn't matter. But I think overall, I still, you know, have an affinity for my teams. That I played for, you know, played with, and, you know, the Phillies, the Cubs. I just find myself paying attention to what they're doing. But I don't know if I have that sort of the innocent childhood way I used to feel about it, like, because I think that kind of went away when I started actually playing professionally, but it was sort of like, "Oh, wow, you know, I just love this team and I can't explain it." But it's a little different, but I still really love the game and I still love to talk about it.
You were back at Wrigley Field recently. I think you led the seventh inning stretch, and that had to be a nice experience. Maybe not so much the singing portion of it, but just having a chance to come back there. And you're in the city, so you get back to Wrigley Field very often?
Yeah, I definitely try to get there as much as possible. I mean, it's such a great place to watch a game, and seventh inning stretch is a lot of blast. It's just a blast. And but yeah, you know, I try to sing as, you know, I try to emulate the spirit of Harry Carey. You know, I try to give him that. And so I'm a little off key, you know, a little bit, whatever it takes. I'm not a singer by any stretch, but it's still a ton of fun. And, you know, outside the first pitch that I threw that almost took off the cameraman's, the photographer's head, I felt like it was a blast. And I was able to do a lot. And, you know, the beauty, you know, I'm really enjoying the book side of things. I think people are very much still supporting it. And I just think any baseball fan would enjoy it. So it was fun to share that, especially from a Cubs perspective. Because so much of my career came through that lens.
And any Cub stories you want to share in our last couple of minutes here? You mentioned Harry Carey. I mean, you were there near the end of his time with us, or Ron Santo, who we sadly lost last year.
Yeah, it was such a pleasure with Ron. He's such a passionate guy, and I wrote an article for the New York Times about Santo and how he just embodied the passion. Well, actually, it's for ESPN.com about his just passion for everything. So it was an honor, and well, you know, I think of a lot of stories. I mean, so many. I mean, Ryan Sandberg, his wife Margaret, if you're out there, I email her once in a while. But she got on me my rookie year because there's a family room is a waiting area where the players meet their, you know, whoever you leave tickets for. But it usually has to be family. That's why it's a family room, of course. The non-family would wait outside in, like, some foyer or some other place, usually, unless they were accompanying a family member. So I had sort of a blindest date came to the game. I didn't really know where to tell her to go. I was like a rookie. I didn't know what I was doing. So she came, and I, you know, forgot. I said, meet me in the parking lot or something. So I get to the family room door, and Margaret Sandberg sort of hands on her hips. She's like, is she waiting for you? I'm like, who? I didn't know what she was talking about. So I looked inside the family room, and my date was there, and she was wearing like a skin-tight snow white bunny suit. And it had like a set of lips on the front that said precious across. And I realized that I'd probably given, you know, or she had given a lot of people a heart attack because the attire was a little bit different than what was typical of the family room. So I was very careful after that about, like, all right, you know, because, you know, the next step is like, okay, anybody you bring could be around people's kids, and you just don't know, especially when these guys are dating, it's like the girlfriend of the week or whatever. You just didn't want, you know, you don't want your kids necessarily interacting. So it's very dicey, but Margaret Sandberg taught me a lot, so I appreciate her.
Today on Focus, we listened back to Jeff Bossert's 2011 Focus show with Doug Glanville, former pro baseball outfielder. We welcome any additional comments or questions you have about today's show on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Focus is produced by Lindsay Moon. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL.